Let's now turn to the topic that we're going to be talking about for the rest of the hour, and that is the situation with antiquities around the world. And antiquities, Sarah, I'd like to begin with you, Sarah Parcak. These are things that have been around since ancient times. I mean, thousands of years. And I'm presuming that over these centuries, people, tribes, cultures have had some respect for these antiquities. Otherwise, it seems that they might have been endangered before this. What has happened that all of a sudden it seems that we are talking about antiquities being so threatened?
Well, first of all, there's a long history of archaeological site looting. Even the famed tomb of King Tut was actually partly looted before it was sealed up. We actually know of fingerprint marks that were left in some of the unguent jars. So this idea that, you know, when archaeologists excavate, we find completely intact tombs, that's really rare. One of the main challenges we faced kind of post-Arab Spring, post-2011, is simply a lack of stability in the Middle East. And many archaeological sites that would have been well guarded have actually been affected by looting. But this is something that actually started before then. It's a problem that has worsened.
And it's not just looting, as we said at the beginning. There have been deliberate efforts, Tess Davis, deliberate efforts by terrorists to destroy, and not just terrorists, by armies as well, to destroy some of these age-old monuments in an apparent effort to destroy an enemy's history, heritage, identity. How does that happen?
Well, what we're seeing now in Iraq and Syria and indeed throughout the region is that heritage is being increasingly used as a terrorist financing tool and, on the other hand, a weapon of war. And, again, this has happened throughout history, but it's being done in a way that's coming into the television sets of people throughout the country and the world that hasn't happened previously. But I think it's important to stress that while these are attacks on buildings, that they're first and foremost buildings and monuments, first and foremost attacks on the Iraqi and Syrian people, which is exactly why ISIS is doing this. This is not just about stones and objects here.
Tess Davis is Executive Director of the Antiquities Coalition. My other guests, and we'll get to this discussion after a break, are Gary Vakan, former director of the Walters Museum of Art in Baltimore, Sarah Parcak, who you heard from earlier, professor of archaeology and Egyptology at the University of Alabama, and we'll be hearing also from Amar al-Azam, former Syrian antiquities official and an active member of the Syrian opposition. He's on the line from Ohio. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about this new war crimes conviction guilty plea. I'm Tom Gelton. Stay tuned.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Hello again. I'm Tom Gelton from NPR. I'm sitting in for Diane Rehm today, and we're talking about the fate of the world's antiquities, now endangered by looting and by war. And speaking of the damage from war, we have a pretty important development this week where we had the first guilty plea, first conviction from the International Criminal Court, where Ahmad al-Mahdi pled guilty to being the ringleader of a group that destroyed some ancient mausoleums in Timbuktu in Mali and apologized for that. Tess Davis, as the executive director of the Antiquities Coalition, you are familiar with this. What exactly was it that Ahmed Almaty and his cohorts did in Timbuktu. What did they destroy, and what has he now pled guilty to?
Well, Almaty was a local leader of Ansar al-Din, which was a homegrown terrorist movement in Mali with close ties to al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb. And when they came into Timbuktu in 2012, Timbuktu, of course, is a hugely important World Heritage Site, an Islamic city of learning with its golden age dating back from the 13th to 17th century. And from this golden age, its mud brick mosque have survived. Thousands of manuscripts have survived. Incredibly important mosque. Again, Islamic heritage. But when Ansar al-Din came into Timbuktu, it was this very heritage that was targeted by Almaty and others for destruction. And so he's now being prosecuted for the destruction of 9 mausoleums of local saints and also for a mosque that was destroyed again in 2012.
And Amr al-Azm, you are not only an active member of the Syrian opposition, you, as I understand it, have been working with people trying to preserve some of the monuments and treasures in Syria. What sort of comparably is happening there? We certainly have heard about the destruction of the archaeological site at Palmyra by ISIS. What is the agenda, as far as you can tell, of ISIS with respect to these old sites?
Right. Yes, I do a lot of work with activists on the ground inside Syria. These are local archaeologists, local museum curators, just local stakeholders who are very concerned about their cultural heritage. They're very connected to it, and they are trying to save it. They're trying to do the best they can. As far as ISIS is concerned, the way we interpret ISIS's actions is that ISIS sees cultural heritage as a resource that they can exploit. So they exploit it on a number of different levels. They loot systematically and very intensively in order to acquire material to sell, to fund their activities. We know that looting is one of the important areas, or at least until recently was an important area of resource and funding for them, but also they destroy cultural heritage, particularly cultural heritage that they cannot loot. So you cannot, you know, a large monument or a temple is unlootable. So then they put it to better use, to other use as far as they're concerned. They destroy it, and this destruction is part of this very powerful message, very powerful propaganda message that says, I am ISIS, I can act with impunity, and the international community and anyone else, local or otherwise, is impotent to try and stop me. There's this powerful combination of impunity and impotence that, it's a powerful message. It resonates well with their own narrow base of followers, and it shocks us. It makes us feel awful. We feel unable to do anything, and it works into their advantage.
And these sites are non-Islamic, right? I mean, they predate the rise of Islam, and in that respect, it's comparable, I guess, to what the Taliban did in Afghanistan to those
Well,
Buddhist
they
statues.
Destroy both. No, this is the thing. They destroy both. They destroy non-Islamic sites, obviously, for this kind of propaganda, as I just explained. But they also are known and have destroyed numerous Islamic sites. And that's, you know, we often associate their destruction of archaeological sites and monuments with this extreme interpretation, iconoclastic interpretation, mm-hmm. where, you know, it's somehow connected to some sort of extreme ideological Islamic interpretation. But really, their destruction of non-Islamic sites has very little to do with that, even though they use this Islamic rhetoric for it. The real Islamic the real ideological religious aspect comes when they destroy Muslim shrines, places of worship, particularly those connected with other sects, Druze or Shiite or otherwise, because for them that is part of a process of purging Islam from what they consider to be non-Islamic or introductions or pollution, if you want. So saint worship, for example, is considered unacceptable in this very strict type of Islam, Wahhabi Islam that they practice, and they see that as a threat and they seek to purge it. And that is very different from when they go out and destroy a monument like the Temple of Bel, who they know very well has no connection to the religion or to people's daily worship and practice, and there's no threat to them.
Sarah Parcak, you're in the forefront of efforts to preserve antiquities, and we're going to get to some of the things that you're doing a little bit later, but I'm wondering how important it is to raise the consciousness of the world, the awareness of the world, at what's at stake with these antiquities, and does this week's guilty plea at the ICC serve any purpose in your mind in that regard, in terms of highlighting this as a problem?
Sure. So when archaeological sites are destroyed and objects are taken from them, every piece that's stolen, every piece that's destroyed contributes to us losing a piece of our shared human identity. You know, people are fascinated about who we are and where we've come from. The fact is, our basic humanity hasn't changed since we've been human. And understanding archaeological sites and our history contributes to our understanding of who we are. So I think the conviction at the ICC hopefully sends a really powerful message. I don't know that it will serve as a deterrent, primarily because most looting is fundamentally economic in nature, but it certainly shows the world just how important it is to consider protecting sites and preserving heritage. And ultimately, that's something that we have to do a better job of protecting as a world.
Now, Sarah, you mentioned earlier that this has been going, looting of these sites has been going on for a long, long time. Nevertheless, I'm guessing that the market for looted antiquities is a relatively modern development. I mean, you mentioned the looting of King Tut's tomb, but over centuries, there really was no market for these antiquities, I assume. Is that not right?
Yeah, I mean, people certainly would break into tombs. A lot of objects end up getting reused. We see a lot of statues, for example, from ancient Egypt that will have one king's name carved out and another one put on, and the same with temples. The reusing definitely has a long and rich history, but certainly the market for antiquities is a much more modern phenomena. And, this is a kind of begs a question, how much has the market increased, especially post Arab Spring? That's something that people like Tess and others have done a really wonderful job of making sure the world understands this is an increasing problem. We've got to understand better the severity of the issue.
Well, speaking of the market for these things, Gary Vakan, as the director, former director of an art museum, you were on this other end. What can you tell us about the demand for these antiquities, the market for these antiquities, and what's a museum's or a collector's role here?
Well, let me first of all say that my book, which is coming out next month, Sacred and Stolen, really has a careful look at what happened after the invasion of Cyprus in 1974. Mm-hmm. And if you could step the clock back right now to 1980, let's say, and look at the market in London, the United States, Amsterdam, Paris, you would find it absolutely flooded with high-end, specific works of art from northern Cyprus that had been looted. The entire interiors of churches were taken out and sold, and museums and private collectors were treating this with great legitimacy. Contrast that with what's going on right now in the Western market in relationship to what's going on in Syria and Iraq. The demand on the Western side has virtually disappeared. Mm. There's been a dramatic...
Why is that?
I think it has to do with, in part, a general awareness of how deplorable being part of this trade is. And so much as we don't smoke inside buildings, much as we don't throw beer cans into ditches anymore, it is unacceptable in the museum community and the collecting community and the dealing community to be involved with objects that are freshly looted out of northern Syria, out of Syria in general, or out of Iraq. But it's really critical, I think, to focus on what's happened in a good way, and to be very critical in how we understand the dimensions of the trade right now in order that we not overstate it and take steps that are ultimately damaging to the public good insofar as they curtail activities in museums as being repositories for the great collections that are still out there and are totally legitimate. And insofar as we're talking about $1 billion or $7 or $15 billion trade out of Syria and Iraq, which is not true, it is not true. To the extent that we believe that, we paint with too broad a brush. And I think we really chill the atmosphere that connects museums to collectors and collectors to museums and the public good. And we mustn't lose sight of that.
But I've certainly heard the argument that once an object has been looted, that it's better to get a hold of that object and preserve it in a safe place rather than let it sort of float around from collector to collector.
Couldn't agree with you more. I believe very strongly in safe harbor. And one of the prominent stories in my book has to do with the entire interior of a 13th century Byzantine church that was looted probably about 1978. And it was bought by a private collector in Houston in 38 pieces, reassembled, displayed in Houston until 2012, and now is back in Nicosia in Cyprus. So she, on her own dime, and that's 1980s dollars of $1.5 million, preserved an entire church and gave it back. And I think we shouldn't lose sight of the role of museums and private collectors in safe harbor in times of high risk. Because right now we ask ourselves, to whom do we return the objects, even if we have them?
Gary Vakhan is former director of the Wolters Museum of Art in Baltimore. I'm Tom Gelton. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Sarah Pukak, as an archaeologist, I want to get your view on this issue of what, institutions, that is, governments, but in particular museums, what should be their attitude towards this market that has really expanded for antiquities?
So I think especially now museums need to be even more cautious and vigilant when they're considering making new acquisitions. I think in particular of the Sandesh Kapoor case and this individual basically contracted people in India to go and loot from temples, and these objects ended up going through the international art market and ended up in museums in Australia and all over the world. And so I think if museums are considering acquiring a piece, they really need to be critical. You know, is it from somewhere in the Middle East? And especially now, with so much conflict, so much looting, and when we know so many pieces are flowing out of the Middle East and North Africa, I think museums really have a job. They need to be really careful in terms of when they want to purchase a piece. But also, I think, in terms of looking at the pieces they already have, where did they come from? You know, when I walk into a museum anywhere in the world and I see that a piece is from somewhere in Southeast Asia, I roll my eyes and think, oh, this is probably taken from a temple. So I think museums need to be more self-critical. You know, I also think they serve a great purpose. You know, they educate our youth, they educate people about the importance of these wonderful cultures around the world. But, you know, especially now that we know so many pieces are being looted, a lot more caution is needed. And many museums have come out with strong statements against looting. But I think this is something we need to see more of.
Tess, we're talking here about museums, but how does this market break down between museums and private collectors? I know that big auction houses like Sotheby's, these antiquities get sold, and they don't always get sold to. Are museums the biggest buyers, or are private collectors very big buyers as well?
Well, the art market's changing a great deal, even in recent months and years, due to the Internet. And things like eBay and the other online auction houses have opened up means that people in no matter what remote town and what remote country can be purchasing these antiquities as well. And you've also seen some of the major auction houses do fewer public auctions and perhaps more sales behind the scene. One thing we do need is more data on the size of the trade. There's still a lot of questions that we don't know and that we're trying to figure out in terms of how big it is that we don't have for these comparable trades like guns and drugs. But the numbers that we do have are, and we do know, are quite shocking. I mean, if you just look at the work of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, of ICE, just since 2007, they've repatriated 7,200 artifacts to over 30 countries around the world. And the Kapoor case, which Sarah mentioned earlier, this is one case out of New York where they have seized between $100 and $150 million worth of antiquities from one dealer. Subhash Kapoor, that's one individual operating almost exclusively with South and Southeast Asian art. So when you take these little pieces, it does add up into a quite significant industry.
Gary, you wanted to put in your view on that.
Well, just in general, we have a tool available to us now that we didn't have 40 years ago, and that's the Internet. And I'm a strong advocate for transparency. So if you want to buy something, or if something's offered to you as a museum director or curator, two things. One, put it on the Internet. Two, go to the country of possible or likely origin and ask them what they think. And if we follow that practice, we will gradually clear title on vast numbers, and there are hundreds of thousands of pieces. I could leave the studio and in 1 hour be at four collections of pre-Columbian art that belong in the public domain, and we need to make transparent these collections in order that they can re-enter the public domain.
Gary Vacan is the former director of the Walters Museum of Art in Baltimore, and as he mentioned, he's the author of a new book, Sacred and Stolen, Confessions of a Museum Director. We're going to take a short break right now, and when we get back, we'll go to your phones and your emails. I have one email here from a woman who wants us to touch on the Native American antiquities that were stolen and sold abroad. Stay tuned. I'm Tom Gelton. Hello again. I'm Tom Gelton from NPR. I'm sitting in for Diane Rehm today, and we're talking about the threat to the world's antiquities, collections, treasures around the world that are being looted or destroyed by terrorists or by warfare. My guests are Tess Davis. He's the executive director of the Antiquities Coalition. Gary Vacan, who's a former director of the Walters Museum of Art in Baltimore. Sarah Parkak, a professor of archaeology and Egyptology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. She also won last year's TED Prize for her idea of using crowdsourcing to combat looting. And I want Sarah to talk about that a bit later. Also, Amr Al-Azam, former Syrian antiquities official and active member of the Syrian opposition. He now teaches at Shawnee State University in Ohio. And Amr, fill us in on the situation in Syria, which is your country. How much has been lost there already? How hopeful are you that in this, with all the war and fighting that's going on, that more can be saved?
I mean, the situation in Syria today is catastrophic at all levels. You have a country that's essentially, and a society more importantly, that has ruptured across every possible cleavage you can think of, socially, politically, economically, ethnically, and so on and so forth. And one of the casualties of this conflict has been cultural heritage. As soon as the conflict shifted from one of essentially civil activism and protests going out into the streets to an armed confrontation between regime and opposition, basically the cultural heritage, the archaeological sites, the monuments became part of the battlefield in many cases. And even in areas where they're not directly in the line of fire, because of the essential breakdown of law and order, the breakdown of services, and just the ability of people to function on a normal level has led to a very, very great increase in damage to cultural heritage, whether it's from the bombardment or from looting. we see a lot of examples of what we refer to today as subsistence looting. This is locals who have no other means of making a living, and we repeatedly, through our interviewing and talking to these local people, you ask them, why are you looting these sites? And they'll say, well, if I don't try to find something to sell, then my family will starve. The factory I used to work at or the store I had that I used to sell goods from has been bombed, has been destroyed, has been robbed, etc. And at the same time, you also have, as this scale of conflict has spread, it's almost unprecedented when I think of how widespread the fighting is in Syria. It's not just in isolated areas. The contact front lines are very, very widespread. And Syria is a very rich country. Literally every Syrian lives either on top of an archaeological site, right next door to an archaeological site, or within a stone's throw of an archaeological site. So wherever you have fighting, you also invariably have some sort of cultural heritage around, and that's also suffered terribly. We've had museums bombed, with airstrikes and indiscriminately so. The Amara Museum, which is one of the museums that we've done a lot of work at, and we've actually been able to save the contents of that museum because the teams that I work with inside Syria were able to sandbag the museum to protect the contents. That museum, for example, was barrel bombed last year by the regime side, and then again this year in May by a Russian airstrike, and had it not been for the sandbagging, it would have been destroyed. But at the end of the day, we have to stay hopeful. We have to keep our hopes up, because it is this cultural heritage that will also help save Syria's future. This conflict will end one day, and when it does end, Syrians are going to have to find some sort of common area, common ground that they can communicate across. And I believe that this cultural heritage is this common denominator. They share, Syrians, no matter which side they're on, have a sense of this shared common history. And there are people on both sides of the conflict trying to save this cultural heritage. Cool. And so for me, saving this cultural heritage is also about saving Syria's future.
Well, those efforts that you describe are truly heroic. And it seems very clear that Syria right now is the epicenter of this problem around the world. I want to go now to Ken, who's on the line from Pennsylvania. Ken, thanks for calling the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. I'm somewhat embarrassed to actually call in. My family has passed on to me the hobby of collecting Asian antiques, but also have passed on to me the methodical research I need to do before I purchase anything. Several years ago, I purchased a tomb horse from what was a reputable antiquities dealer outside of Beijing, and had done my research and bought several pieces off this gentleman. And I was looking for a tomb horse, and again, did my research to make sure it was coming from a legitimate source. After about 2 years, I finally received it, only to be contacted from Interpol 6 months later to find out that this antiquities dealer, they had been watching him for several years, and when he would get a request from an American to purchase something, he was actually sending his workers out, and they were robbing tombs. As a result, Interpol offered to fly me over to Europe to testify against this gentleman. I coincidentally ended up sending the piece back. But this is a perfect example of a private collector like myself who has done my research only to find out that there's ways that these people can get around it. And I thought I was doing the right thing. But
well, as you said, you thought it was a reputable dealer, but you learned otherwise. Tess Davis, how familiar is that Ken's story to you?
It is unfortunately very familiar, and I've actually been working with the Kingdom of Cambodia in the last 12 years, first researching the illicit trade in blood antiquities from their long conflict in the 1970s and onward, and then more recently with the government as it is seeking to bring these pieces home. And when you see the pieces that Cambodia has recovered, again, all looted after the major international agreement in 1970, all looted during the war, that they've recently recovered from premier institutions, auction houses and museums and collectors in the United States, that nonetheless were conflict antiquities, were blood antiquities in every sense of the word. And when you can see an institution like Sotheby's or like the Metropolitan Museum of Art, with the resources they have at their disposal, with the lawyers they have at their disposal. And yet still, they are often purchasing these things. It is a very strong message of buyer beware. And one thing we are pushing for is more regulation in the art market, because it protects not only countries like Cambodia, but also individual collectors as well. The art market is very unusual in that you can spend over $100 million on a piece at auction and not have the legal right to know the name of the person who is selling it to you. In what other world does that happen?
Gary?
Well, I mean, just to complement or to kind of complete that thought process, the vast majority of ancient and medieval art in American collections is without title. You would not buy a car without title. You wouldn't buy a house without title. But when you buy a work of art, and this is true now, and it was true 80 years ago, you get it without title.
Sarah Parkak, let's talk a little bit about Egypt. You are an Egyptologist, and you also you are very familiar with what has gone on in terms of looting of archaeological treasures in Egypt. Fill us in on that, and fill us in on your novel ideas for how that might be combated.
Sure. So there's been a big question. You know, obviously there's been an increase in looting in Syria and Iraq, but what about in a place like Egypt, which is much more stable? So working with my team and with support from the National Geographic Society, we looked at open source satellite imagery from 2002 to 2013 at every known and a lot of previously unknown archaeological sites in Egypt. We mapped over 200,000 looting pits. And what we found was really interesting. While looting did get worse after 2011, after the Arab Spring, we saw a big spike after 2009, which we think is very closely connected to the economic recession. Getting back to Amr's point that this is fundamentally economic in nature, but this is a project that took our team many, many months. So this idea that we have using the TED Prize funding is that we're going to create an online citizen science crowdsourcing platform to allow anyone in the world to help us look at satellite imagery and identify possible new sites as well as map looting. I should say, by the way, all the data online, I'm not going to have any GPS information. We're going to be protecting the sites. We're starting in Peru. This is a project where we're working in very close collaboration with Peru's Ministry of Culture and on-the-ground collaborators. And the main reason is because, you know, you have people all around the world that want to own history, they want to own objects. And my challenge to them instead is help be a part of making history. You know, we want to empower everyone in the world and give them the chance to help make these great discoveries and help protect sites. All the data is going to be shared with, we're starting in Peru, we'll expand globally, but this data will be shared with ministries, with archaeologists, and the world will get to help engage with discovery. You know, they say history is written by the winners. I think the history of the world should be written by everyone, and the idea is that we'll use this platform to do that.
I'm curious, Sarah, what you can see from a satellite that will, you know, alert you to what's going on. I mean, can you get that kind of detailed information from satellite imagery?
So fortunately and unfortunately, looting is very easy to spot from satellite images. I could teach anyone how to spot looting in a matter of minutes. You tend to get a dark oval shape surrounded by a donut of earth where looters have gone in and dug up a bit of a tomb or part of a settlement. And it's really easy to spot visually clusters of this activity. So the idea is that when people log onto this platform, which is going to launch early next year, they can actually help identify areas that have been looted. And for us, the most time-consuming part is scanning the imagery and finding the looting. So the idea is that the world can help process data really, really quickly. And we can get that data to people on the ground. Right now, you know, if looting is happening, archaeologists will find it if they're searching imagery, but it can take us a long time. And if I'm looking at an image from 3 years ago and I find looting, that doesn't really help governments in terms of protecting sites. So we've got to work faster. We've got to work more efficiently. And we're really lucky that we've got new technologies like satellites and drones that can help us to identify areas that are being affected.
Well, I'm sure that a lot of Egyptians feel very strongly about preserving their country's heritage. Just as Amr said about the Syrian people, this is something that goes to the heart of a people's heritage, and there is a natural desire, I'm sure, to want to protect it. So I'm betting that that effort on your part will pay off. I want to go now to Storm, who's on the line from Baltimore, Maryland. Hello, Storm. Thanks for calling the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was calling because I was wondering about repatriation of artifacts, and, you know, just, I guess, a twofold question. So, like, how do you guys feel repatriation of artifacts should be done in cases, for example, like with Britain and India, where they previously had colonized India, but then how do you feel... you know, what is the responsibility of the country that is then taking in those objects? So when you look at, like, Italy and Egypt, both countries have, my understanding is they've had a huge influx of repatriated artifacts, so they don't necessarily have the resources to properly upkeep and maintain in order to preserve that history.
Okay. Before we get to that question, let me remind our listeners that this is the Diane Rehm Show. Anyone want to take that question, Tess?
Hi, yes. I've been very honored to be a very small part of the Kingdom of Cambodia's efforts to recover its conflict antiquities, again, that were taken during its long war with the Khmer Rouge. And would just like to stress, first of all, how important this is to both the kingdom and everyone there. I mean, and I think one sign of that is that the negotiations have been done by their Secretary of State, His Excellency Chan Teni, which shows... again, how important this is. Because, as I said earlier, this is not just, especially in the case of conflict antiquities, this is not just about objects. This is part of history and culture and identity and recovering that and rebuilding it. And Cambodia, like Syria, hopefully will soon. You know, when they did rebuild, when peace came, it was on the foundation of this culture. It was crucial. And museums and collectors both, I think, are faced with a choice today, whether to recognize these repatriation request. They can look at it as an obstacle or they can look at it as an opportunity. And many, and I think an increasing number, are looking at it as an opportunity. Cambodia has been able to build fantastic relationships with institutions here in the United States. The Met especially stepped up right away when confronted with this claim and, to their credit, did the right thing without waiting for a court order, without waiting for any lawsuit. And actually Christie's Auction House did as well. And I think both those institutions and the country are benefiting from it because Cambodians, the ones I've spoken with at last, they want people to see their art around the world. It gives them great pride mm-hmm. that people around the world want to see this. They just want it to be done in a responsible way that doesn't lead to the very destruction of this art that we're purporting to protect.
Amr Al-Azam, I think you wanted to jump in.
Yes, it was something, just to follow up from something Sarah was saying about using satellite imagery, and of course we use that too in Syria, but more importantly, it's the connection between having teams on the ground that are able to go in and verify what is being shown on those satellite images that is so critical, and it's that combination between having local stakeholders that are able to see this activity on the ground, report it to you, and then have that also matched up with what you have coming out on the satellite images. It's that combination of the two areas that really make this such a powerful tool for us in terms of tracking looting of antiquities.
We're almost at the end of a program, but I have a couple of emails here, Gary, that I want you to address.
Sure.
They're important. For Mary writes, what do I do when I find out that a member of my extended family is a black market antiquities dealer? I make several trips a year to collect them, then sells them in the U.S. Susanna is asking about a ring in her family's possession that her father-in-law claims is from a looted, pharaohic Egyptian gravesite. What should people do very quickly when...
Well, if I had that ring, I would go to the embassy here in Washington, D.C., or if you're not that close, send them an email with a picture and ask them what they think about it. Mm-hmm. And if they want it back, give it back.
Mm-hmm. And is there an agency that people, for example, Mary, who says that her family is, someone in her family is engaged in this, who should she go to?
Well, she should go to the member of the family. They're breaking the law, and it's a time to come to Jesus.
Yeah, well, Gary Vacan is the former director of the Walters Museum of Art in Baltimore and author of the new book, Sacred and Stolen. We have been discussing today the problem of looted and destroyed antiquities around the world, a growing problem, a very serious problem. I'd like to thank my other panelists as well, Tess Davis, Executive Director of the Antiquities Coalition, Sarah Parkak, a professor of archaeology and Egyptology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, and Amr Al-Azam, a former Syrian antiquities official who now teaches at Shawnee State University in Ohio. Earlier, when we were talking about the earthquake in Italy, we were joined by Deborah Ball of the Wall Street Journal. Thanks to all our listeners. Apologies we didn't get to you. Many people had questions that we just didn't have time for. I'm Tom Gelton. This is the Diane Rehm Show.